Welcome to World History Podcast. This podcast is about Africa. My name is Professor Lisa Namikis, and I'm here with you today to talk about what we know about African history and Ethiopia. We have with us, too, our interviewer, Ryan Pierce, and he's going to help us by asking a few questions, and let's get started. Let me ask you this, Ryan. What do you know about Africa?
Well, interesting that you asked me that question, because when I think back, what comes to mind, maybe pyramids? Ancient Egypt, pharaohs and mummies and whatnot. That's the thing that stands out. And then, you know, of course, the colonization of Africa in the 1800s and 1700s. So I really draw a blank for most of it. But there seems like a big gap in between those two.
Well, that's true. It is very common. If we think about it, there are about 4,000 years between the events that you mentioned. The pyramids were built about 2500 BC and the slave trade arose about 1700s and then colonization after that. So it seems like there's little reason to know about Africa south of the Sahara because so many of us say that it was isolated anyway in world history and really had little influence or impact. Just as we also say the Americas were isolated by the oceans from what was going on in the Mediterranean world. But in the case of Africa, it's just not true. Africa had many connections to the rest of the world.
It did seem like 4,000 years is a lot of history that I was unaware of. Why does it seem so hard to know?
Well, that's a great question. First, Africa didn't have ancient historians who wrote things down like Sima Qian in China or Thucydides in ancient Greece. Instead, many African civilizations had griots who were record keepers, storytellers, and moral guides all wrapped in one. They kept records orally, meaning they memorized entire histories with entire lessons and their meanings and dates and figures and facts. They spent years, sometimes even 20 years, training and learning before they took over as head griot.
Oh my goodness, they must have had to remember a lot of things.
Well, they did indeed. And when writing came along, these griots tended to lose their role. And as a result, we've lost some of their stories and their histories.
Okay, but maybe we should write down all the stories of the griots, don't you think?
That raises another good point about the challenge of African history. So colonization has had a major impact on how we see Africa. When the Europeans arrived, they conquered many of the civilizations and memories have been lost or reshaped. And how African history is remembered is different now. So for instance, if Europeans are writing down the stories of the griots, then they write down what they see as important, not necessarily the full story. All this does not make it impossible to know African history, but we just want to be aware of some of the challenges.
So what I'm hearing is that it's really important to pay attention to the history and think about how we talk Africa and other civilizations. We might have assumptions about regions and places, but they're not always true.
That's exactly right. So there are so many examples. We could talk about the famous empires in West Africa, like Ghana or Mali, or Great Zimbabwe in South Africa, or even the kingdoms around the Congo River. But with only the little time that we have in this podcast, I'm going to concentrate on Ethiopia. Ethiopia is a great example of a country that has a lot of connection with the rest of the world. Even in Ethiopia today, there is so much history everywhere you turn, and it is celebrated by everyone in the country. And this history connects Ethiopia with the world around it. Ethiopia also sees itself as one of the only continuously independent African countries because it was never colonized by Europeans in the 19th century. You know, let's go on a live tour of the country and we'll talk about the many attractions that we see along the way, kind of like a travelogue. You can keep one and I can keep one. Do you like traveling?
I sure do. And this one sounds like it's a tour off the beaten path. Are Ethiopians friendly?
Oh, they are so friendly. We won't get a fake touristy experience, but like any area, it's always good to be aware of your surroundings, so check the State Department website before traveling and find out if it's safe. And today is fairly safe, so are you ready? Let's go on a tour. We'll use Ethiopian Airlines and we'll fly into Addis Ababa, the capital city. It's one of the highest cities in Africa, so you don't need to worry about mosquitoes carrying malaria there. The first gate at Bole International Airport that you walk through has a big sign over it saying Land of Origins. And we'll point out a few origins as we go on our tour.
I'm ready. I had a few vaccinations, those you would want before you go travel to many places around the world. And I also have a visa, so come on, let's go.
Did you bring your umbrella? So June to September is the rainy winter season, but it's still okay to travel. Just be ready for a few late afternoon downpours. February to April, they're good months to go to. So whatever time you travel, just try to coordinate it with a major celebration. They're always fun to incorporate into your trip. We're going to hop around the country a bit, so make sure you have on good walking shoes. First, I'll just throw out a few facts. There are 9 different ethnic groups, major groups. The official language is Amharic, and the money is called birr. Remember Dinknesh or Lucy? We talked about her in our prehistory podcast. Dinknesh is the name that she was given by the Ethiopians, but Lucy, remember, was the name given by the British archaeologists. Dinknesh is the oldest hominid discovered in Hadar. It's in the Afar region. It's part of the Great Rift Valley, which you can kind of compare to the Grand Canyon, only it's much larger. Hadar is about 185 miles northwest from Addis, so we'll take a taxi for a day trip there. Ethiopia is so proud of the fact that many hominid species have been found here. The bones are stored in the National Museum in Addis Ababa. They're very fragile, so most of the displays that you see are reproductions. Altogether, about 240 hominids were found here from about 3 million years ago. Not far away from Hadar is the Danakil Desert. It is the hottest place on Earth, literally. The average temperature is 95 degrees, and it can oftentimes reach 122 degrees. It's one of the lowest places on Earth, so some of the bodies of water that you'll see in the desert are full of bubbling sulfur and other minerals, so much that it looks yellow or bright green. Against the salty, dry desert, it's breathtaking sometimes, but literally also, it can take your breath away and be hard to breathe. So those that go there love it, but it's not for the average traveler.
I'm not sure. It sounds pretty rugged.
Yeah, don't worry. We have a lot of other things to see, so we'll move on.
Wow, this is all amazing. There's a coffee shop? Let's stop. At home, I buy really good coffee from Ethiopia. Has coffee played a role in Ethiopia's history, by the way?
Well, yes, it has. In fact, our next destination is the southern regions of the country, where the land is lush and green. Here is where most of the coffee is grown, in Yirgacheffe, Sidama, Kaffa, and Harar. Today, Ethiopia is the 5th largest coffee producer, and coffee is half of the exports and brings in most of its foreign currency. Ethiopians drink about half of the coffee produced there, and that is a lot. They love the coffee ceremony late in the afternoon. It takes about 2 or 3 hours, depending on the time you have. Usually, women prepare the coffee, and it starts with roasting the beans over the fire and then steeping those beans in hot water, pouring the water back and forth between pots, and finally drinking small espresso-like cups that have a lot of sugar added to it, so it's slightly sweet. It's polite to have 3 cups. At the end, remember to say Tirubuna. It means good coffee, and your hostess will be very happy. Ethiopians were one of the first to harvest coffee beans by about the 4th or 5th century. It's believed, in fact, that the coffee plant originated here and spread to the rest of the world. Ethiopia brought coffee into Arabia in the 6th century and introduced coffee not only to the Arabs, but to Sufi Muslims who used coffee to reduce their sleepiness and focus more on prayer. And in this way, they also introduced coffee to all other Muslim groups, and then to Europeans finally by the 16th century.
Ethiopia's coffee is a great example of how trade has connected people, and I will remember to stay for 3 cups.
Now that we've had our coffee, let's stop in the middle of the country at Lake Tana. It's about 350 miles from Addis, and we can see the different landscape compared to the Danakil Desert. It also reminds us of the connection to the rest of Africa, especially Egypt. Lake Tana feeds the Blue Nile and then the Nile River. It's a beautiful place where you can go boating and relax and enjoy nature. But this is just a stopover. We really want to get to Tigray province in the north of the country.
Why Tigray province?
There's a lot to see in Tigray. Ethiopian Airlines will bring us there in a few hours.
As we fly into Mekelle, the capital city of Tigray, I see it as a very beautiful land. But the airport is a little small, and there is no covered walkway.
Yeah, you're right. And we're lucky it's not raining either. So remember, we're off the beaten path and we see history where it's all started. We are going to travel to a city called Aksum. It's named after the ancient empire. The Aksumite Empire began about the 1st century in the current era. Let's go and we can see the tall obelisks or stelae that are here. They're like tall carved pillars, kind of like the Washington Monument. There's about 10 of these stelae all around. King Izana built a few of the stelae himself, although some were already standing. In the 3rd century, King Izana welcomed Christianity to Ethiopia, and he himself will become Christian. You can see the stelae from a distance once you're already in Aksum, but to see them closer up, we enter a small museum. Then we can walk around the grounds. Be ready, though, foreigners or Ferengi have to pay more. It's kind of like that in a lot of places, like in Asia and Eastern Europe. Even though it sounds like a lot, maybe 500 birr, it still works out to only a few dollars, though.
I also see a big church.
That's the Church of St. Mary of Zion. I'm going to talk about that church a little bit later. If we really want to see the beautiful history of Christian churches in Ethiopia, we need to go to Lalibela. Lalibela is a World Heritage Site. We can take a bus right there. It's a bit long, maybe about 8 hours, but there's always buses coming and going. It's famous for its churches cut out of rock in the mountains. The churches were designed during the Zagwe dynasty in the same area. It's kind of the ancient as ancient Aksumite, but the Zagwe dynasty existed from about the 9th to the 13th century, when its most famous leader, Gebre Meskel Lalibela, was born. His mother said that a swarm of bees surrounded him, and she understood that this was a sign that he would be a future emperor. So she took him to Jerusalem to spend much time there when he was young. And now people go with their prayers and their dreams, and they pray for the intervention of God into their lives, you know, as they enter these churches in Lalibela.
Bees surrounded him? Why bees?
Why bees? Bees symbolize wisdom in Ethiopia's Tigrinya culture, so it makes sense.
Professor Lisa, thanks for taking us to Lalibela. And the bus ride back to Aksum wasn't that bad. But I have a feeling you want to talk more about the Church of St. Mary.
Oh, you're right, I do. And here's where the legend and history coincide. So after the Zagwe dynasty came the Solomonic dynasty, and that dynasty would last to our day. The justification or origins for the Solomonic dynasty are found in a book called the Kebra Nagast, which was written in 1322. The book tells us that the Queen of Sheba traveled to Israel.
Wait. I think I heard of the Queen of Sheba before. Wasn't she mentioned in the Bible in the Old Testament? I remember a story from Sunday school. She brought a caravan of gifts for King Solomon.
Yeah, the Ethiopians believe that the Queen of Sheba was from Aksum, and she linked Ethiopia to Israel and then through that connection to Christianity later. Solomon was the Israelite king in the 10th century BC. Legend has it that they got married and she had his son. Today, we can visit some of the historical places that claim to be part of this tradition. So in Aksum, we can start at the Queen of Sheba's palace, and not too far away is her bath or pool dug into the side of a mountain. The palace was made of stone and bricks, and only about 2 or 3 feet of the outline of the rooms remain. You can walk through the palace area. It's all grassy, and you can see where the rooms were. You can wonder how she lived in the buildings. There's a little kitchen area and a bedroom area. And guess what? You can all do this for free. It's amazing.
Really? That's a great way to share history.
Actually, it is. And there's more to the legend. It's believed that the Queen of Sheba's son, Menelik, later returned from Israel, and on his way home, his aides brought the Ark of the Covenant, carrying the stones with parts of the Ten Commandments. An ark is like a trunk or a box, and Menelik reasoned that since the ark did not destroy them on the way home, it was meant to be with him. So they kept the ark at a church in Aksum for safekeeping.
So you're saying that the Ark with the Ten Commandments is right now, currently in Ethiopia, right now?
Well, according to the Ethiopians, it is. And there's about 10 other places around the world that claim to have the Ark and parts of the Ten Commandments as well. So it's a bit up to debate which is the real one. But in Ethiopia, we can view the home of the Ark, the church where it is presumably held. The church is Our Lady of Mary of Zion, and it became home to the Ark of the Covenant.
Now, we've talked before about paying for certain things and not paying for others. So in this case, do we have to pay to see the Ark too?
Well, this one you can't actually see. And currently the church is closed for repairs, so we can only see the dome of the church from the outside.
Well, if some of the history has not been verified, how do we know what to believe?
That's a great question. So the story of the Queen of Sheba and the legend of the Ark maybe did or did not exist for real, but their stories did. And it's the stories and the legends that are important to understanding Ethiopia and its view of history. The stories themselves have become the history. So, for example, the Solomonic dynasty of Ethiopia traces its lineage back to the Queen of Sheba for 1,000 years or more. And it only ends in our time with Haile Selassie's regime in 1974. So to honor the Queen of Sheba, and the legend honors the dynasty of Haile Selassie too. Every emperor had themselves crowned at the Church of St. Mary to emphasize that connection.
So is everyone in Ethiopia Christian? The Christian history does seem to be pretty important.
Well, that's another great question. Christians are dominant, but they're not the only important religious group in Ethiopia. One important part of Ethiopia's history is often left out, and that is the Muslim influence and presence. One of the most important places for Islamic history is Massawa, actually located today in the small state of Eritrea on the Red Sea coast. Today, Eritrea can be difficult to enter, but up until the 1990s, it was part of Ethiopia. It is on the coast, and its beaches are some of the prettiest in the world. And if you can get a visa, you can go scuba diving in some of the best and cleanest waters off the Dahlak Islands. Muslims arrived in Ethiopia in the 7th century and landed at Massawa. Ethiopia was one of the earliest sanctuaries after Muslims were fleeing from the Quraysh traders in Mecca. The Ethiopian ruler gave them freedom and let them build the first mosque here. Today, about 33% of Ethiopians are Muslim. They're concentrated in the eastern provinces bordering Somalia and are from many different ethnic groups. One Islamic hub in Ethiopia is found at Harar in the northeast. And historically, Muslims have been marginalized and have had little political influence. They didn't even have the right to own land until very recently. But their history is definitely one thing that's being written more about. More about this history appears in later years after 1500 when our class ends. And so we leave that to a little bit later. There is much more to see in Ethiopia. So if you can stay longer, consider it. And you can enjoy the food too. Ethiopian food is some of the best food in Africa. A slightly sour flatbread is called injera. It's usually topped with some kinds of meat and lentil stews or vegetables. But now this brings us to the end of our tour, and so we're back in Louisiana. But even in Louisiana, we can find global connections all around us. In fact, we can even taste Ethiopia's amazing food right here in New Orleans. There's a wonderful restaurant called Addis Nola. It's on Bayou Road in New Orleans, and it's consistently rated one of the best restaurants, not only in New Orleans, but among Ethiopian food in the United States. When you walk into the restaurant, you can feel as if you were right in Ethiopia. The restaurant has tables, but if you look, you'll see a masop or a woven table where people would traditionally stand and eat. You'll also see special artwork all around the walls reflecting the different ethnic groups from the country. Prince Lobo is the owner and manager of the restaurant Addis Nola, and I recently interviewed him. And here's part of the interview. Welcome, Prince Lobo. Thank you so much for interviewing with us. Can you tell us a little bit about your connection to Ethiopia?
Well, my mother's Ethiopian. She left when she was about 14. She went to school in Czech Republic. She went to school in Prague, and that's where she met my father, who was from Central Africa, where I was born. And at a young age, at about 2, she decided to come to America to go back to school. And from there, you know, I was pretty much raised in Baton Rouge for the majority of my life with my mother, who was from Addis, from the capital of Ethiopia. You know, all that time being spent away from home, you know, it can feel sad. It can feel, you know, a lot of things. But she wanted to try to bring a piece of her home to New Orleans after being here for more than 20 years, 2 decades. And so the restaurant was her way of doing that.
Ethiopian food has ancient origins. Food can tell us so much about how the people lived. What, Prince Lobo, in your opinion, are some of the unique traditions related to food?
Oh, absolutely. Once a month, In Ethiopian culture, they have something called a mahaber. A mahaber pretty much just translates to like getting together. And so every month they would host our my mother's some friends of hers would host a mahaber, and then it would kind of be like a potluck of the sort. They would all bring their best dishes and their foods, and we would pretty much just have an opportunity to enjoy the best of this ancient Ethiopian cuisine for at least, for the along my entire childhood growing
Are there any special foods that you think best represent Ethiopian culture?
up. Some of the best will always be the dorowat. That's the national dish of Ethiopia. Doro translates to chicken, and wat is this stew, which really is kind of the staple of this dish is this caramelized onions that they a lot of onions that they low cook. They low heat simmer for 6 hours, 7 hours when you're cooking it personally in your own home. For us at the restaurant, we cook it for about 24 hours with the chicken and then a whole boiled egg as well. The reason why that dish is so important is because it's actually normally done during holidays as a dish, a celebratory dish, just something used as a celebration because it is a labor of love and it takes a long bit of time in order to have it fully prepared and finished whenever you're eating it. So that's one of the really, really, really big staples that you'll find on really special occasions in Ethiopia. That's definitely the most popular. And then one of the most important things to consider whenever we're talking about Ethiopian food is the injera, the bread itself, right? That flatbread that takes at least about 3 days to ferment. One of the using teff, one of the oldest grains in the world. That in itself is not a complete dish, but it is something that is essential in Ethiopian cuisine.
Doro wat and the bread injera sound amazing. I know the injera has a nice tangy flavor, and the doro wat spices are rich in flavor too, especially with pepper and tomato. Injera is made of teff, it's the most ancient grain in the world. What about the coffee ceremony? Can you tell us anything about this tradition?
Oh yeah, Ethiopian coffee. Ethiopia is the origin of coffee. It's the birthplace and the home. They say the Kefa region in Ethiopia was where it was discovered, and it's customary after every meal to do a coffee ceremony where they'll roast the beans for you, and you have a chance to use that as a way to finish the meal, and kind of that would be kind of the commencement of an engagement wherever you're at.
From everything you've said, family seems so important.
Well, Ethiopia is in the continent of Africa with 54 countries. Ethiopia is the only one that's never been fully it's never been colonized ever. So it's one of those cultures where they have such a pride and a sense of self because they haven't lost any of it. They've been doing these foods for the last 2,000 years, and it's just one of those things that it really is an experience whenever you get together and come together around injera. It really is an experience to sit down and be with family, friends, and just share this meal. And it's not to be missed whatsoever.
We're ready to eat.
It's I think one of the best what we like to believe is one of the best Ethiopian restaurants in the South. Why? Because there's not that much exposure to Ethiopian cuisine in the South at all, and we really pride ourselves on bringing that to the community and to our people. And we make it an experience. We have a hand washing station where you can wash your hands before you get into this finger food experience with friends. And it's always been about sharing the culture, the love of African cuisine and culture to our local community. And it's Addis Nola's the name of the restaurant. Addis being the capital of Ethiopia, and Nola obviously being New Orleans, Louisiana. So not a fusion, but really just bridging the gap between both and allowing people to have that experience in their own backyards and their own community, and to cherish and really take with them.
What a great way to end our tour. Thank you so much, Prince Lobo. And again, the restaurant is called Addis Nola, and it is just off Esplanade, north of the 10, before you get to Broad Street. We can enjoy some traditional, authentic Ethiopian food right here in Louisiana and continue to learn more about other people from around the world by trying their cuisine and learning more about their everyday life and just talking to people we meet. And we can all come together and share experiences at the same time. So thank you so much. That ends our tour of Ethiopia. I hope you enjoyed it and learned a lot. So why not search for another blog or more information about some other region of Africa that we didn't have a chance to touch on, like Ghana or Congo or Zimbabwe? Explore and travel. Thank you.
This podcast episode has been produced under a CC by NCND license. All episodes in this series are made possible through the efforts of Lisa Naminkus, Christopher Gilson, Crescentio Jackson, Ryan Pierce, and Amelia Brister. Thank you for listening.